chapters were explained to the next piece is that it's Joram, who is one of the sons of Ahab. So there you go. Chapter one was the firstborn, and I assume that Joram is going to make him the secondborn. So you got another descendant of Ahab here, the great evil king of the north. And we have just finished up with Elisha picking up the mantle of Elijah, the great proof that he's not only picked up his clothes, which is what the mantle actually is, but that he has a double portion of God's Spirit. And so I'm going to quickly finish up chapter 2, but we're going to focus in on chapter 3 for today. So in chapter 2, just to give you a few verses, you might look along with me here. In verse 14, right as Elijah dropped the mantle and Elisha picked it up, Elisha struck the water himself and it parted to the right and the left, and Elisha crossed over. So you have this kind of new great entrance into the promised land, and I want to reiterate that this is how God reminds the people of Israel and reminds us that God has already defeated the enemies, his enemies, the people of God's enemies, because that's what the Red Sea means. When he crossed the Red Sea, Pharaoh and all of his chariots fall behind and they are wiped. So when God's people enter the promised land and they see Jericho ahead and all these other wars in the book of Joshua, they have this backward-looking faith that helps them look forward. So the battles are already won. Jericho might as well already be defeated. The high lands are already taken care of. God has done this and will do it again. So now you have this with Elijah, who Elijah just crossed out of the promised land. Elisha goes to follow him as he's pushed up into Jordan and crosses back again on dry land. Anything else you might remember about the Jordan River that's particularly important to us about the New Testament? Remember the baptism of Jesus? Of course, this is where John the Baptist was giving all these great reminders to God's people, saying, remember the past, how God defeated our enemies? You have a greater enemy, and it's your sin. Repent of your sin and be forgiven. That's what baptism is. Is the trust that God can do something about your sin, a public declaration of your faith. And of course, we see that ultimately in Jesus, the one who has, yes, defeated God's enemies in the past, but has defeated our enemies in the future and all to come. So, just for free, this bonus today, we remember what God has done, and we can remember that God will defeat our future enemies that we haven't faced. So that's Elisha taking on these 50 prophets who are with him. They're called sons of the prophets. They are insistent that, hey, we need to go search out, where's Elijah? And Elisha, I know where he is. And so he finally allows them to go and search for him. And then we're told about Elisha's second miracle rather quickly. In verse 19, the men of the city said to Elijah, my lord can see that even though the city's location is good, the water is bad and the land unfruitful. Verse 20, Elisha replied, bring in a new bowl, put some salt in it. And they had brought him one. Elisha went out to the spring, threw salt in it, and said, this is what the Lord says, I have healed this water. No longer will death or unfruitfulness result from it. So, second miracle, there you go. We're moving quickly because there's 14 of these miracles that Elisha does. Once again, just to remind us, Elijah had 7 miracles, and Elisha gets a double portion of the Spirit, so 14. There you go. Now, this might be the funniest miracle, if you want to even call it a miracle. But verse 23 has some boys And if you know small boys, maybe you can picture this happening. They are chanting at Elisha, "Go up, Baldy, go up, Baldy." Does anyone else have a different translation there? Yeah. Looked at them, cursed them in the name of the Lord, and then two female bears came up out of the woods and mauled 42 of the children. Okay. Yeah. It's the funniest part of the Bible by far. It just has to be. But at the same time, this is the role of a prophet that we need to have him fully in hand, and that the author here is kind of reminding us these prophets were highly disrespected and hated. In the northern kingdom, and that kind of spread throughout the land, even in the south, where it was going back and forth between good kings and bad kings. You have these kids even growing up not realizing this is someone who has the voice of God, who has been given the very words of God to say to us. There's no paying any attention. So I don't want to say that this is anything malicious against small boys. This is a widespread issue in even the southern kingdom, but particularly the north when it comes to prophets. We could say a few things about that, but we're going to go and focus in on that in chapter 3. So verse 25, here's where we are. From there, Elisha went to Mount Carmel, and then he returned to Samaria. Has gone back to the stomping grounds of Elijah to say Mount Carmel. That's where the prophets of Baal were slaughtered, where they were deemed as false prophets. Of course, they kept Deuteronomy and killed the false prophets, claiming we have a word from God. They lost in dramatic fashion as fire fell from heaven. So that's where Elisha goes. And then he returns to Samaria, which is the capital of the northern kingdom. Alright, what else? Questions at all? Things you want to clarify before we go into chapter 3? Alright. Well, Mike can have some help here. We can start out just with reading verse 1, 2, and 3 of chapter 3. Something was learned from Mount Carmel. Okay, this Baal is not a real god. This is a statue we made. My dad made this statue, and I'm going to tear it down. It was nothing. There's some wisdom there. Not enough to get him out of his evil idolatry, and I think that's what's being referred to here in verse 3 about continuing in the sons of Jeroboam and Nebat. This is talking about the first king who caused this whole civil war in the first place. Establishing a mockery cult religion, a cult version of what the Israelites were told to do in the first place. They made a golden cow. They said, this place up here is going to be the holy place now. Here's where we're all going to worship. Don't go to Jerusalem. So I think that's what we're being told here. This is a lot of boring detail and political intrigue. Or maybe this is the kind of reason why you don't go to the Book of Kings. You know, too many names, too much to keep up with. And so in verse 4, we're told about the king of Moab and how he would pay the king of Israel, so the king of the north, in the hundreds of thousands of lambs and the wool of hundreds of thousands of Jehoshaphat, the king of the south, the descendant of David, who was a good king, you might include. And so Joram, the son of Ahab, has to try and convince Jehoshaphat to come and fight Moab. And more than that, we're going to be told here in verse 9 that also the king of Edom even joins them. Quick reminder, who's the line of Edom? Who does he come from? What's so important? Yeah, Esau, so David's brother, or we could say Israel's brother, if you want to go with that. And so now you have three kings all going after Moab. And here's where I want to start. In verse 9, they travel their indirect route for 7 days. They have no water for the army or the animals with them. If I have some help reading verse 10 and 11, and then somebody else, verse 12 and 13, and then we're going to take a pause in that board, verse 14. Yeah, verse 14 and then we'll stop. Okay, so here we go. You have a king of the north who once again has his own cult of religion joining King Jehoshaphat to approach Elisha. What does God say? And it's very interesting. The king of Israel is already convinced that God hates him, and because he's involved with it, it's going to be his doom. It's actually going to be the end of all of these three kings' lives. We're all going to die. That's essentially his great takeaway. We're talking to a prophet of Yahweh. I'm clearly dead. He looks at his brother, he looks at his dad, and how they ended up. And I think that's essentially what he's getting out of this. Something very interesting happens in verse 15, where Elisha asked for a musician to be brought, and while the musician played, the Lord's hand came on Elisha. Very interesting. And I'm just curious your thoughts here, why this might be. That it's a musician that comes and plays, and Elisha has the hand of God on him. I just hope it wasn't a liar. That evil spirit to leave him, it was as if the spirit was tormenting Saul more so than possessing him or anything like that. The tormenting spirit was to have David, before he was king, come and play the harp. And that was it. And the spirit would leave, and a good spirit, of course, would come on Saul. It was very, very interesting. But this is what God did. There's something about someone know, you maybe thought about how what Israel did when they crossed the Red Sea. The very first thing they do is they sin. And I really don't want to make too much of this, but to say nothing else, there is an undoubted vehicle that music is for worship and for a clinging to God's truth. There's something in that. I don't know what, but there's something in that. There's a lot of variations. I would not have been, anyway. Without music. Well, and I always remember growing up and like other kids saying about heaven, is all we're going to do sing all the time? It's not like you're trapped in a musical theater. It's not that kind of moment. It's all you're caught up in worship, and you worship in more ways than just song. But it's a clear connection here. God's word, song, it doesn't talk about words that are being said. It talks about music. So there's something redemptive about music. It's a vehicle that truth can be used to carry in. Alright, well, here is the word in verse 16 and 17. And I don't really know what a wadi is. I don't have a good idea what a wadi might be. I think of rice paddies when I think of wadi. Do you have a different word here in verse 16 and 17 for what kind of what's going to happen in this ditch? It's going to turn into a ditch. Okay. Awesome. Okay. Yep. That's me. What do you have? Verse 16 and 17. So the Lord says, dig ditch after ditch in this. Do you have a valley as well? Okay, yeah. So this feels, so my best mental picture of what this is, and please chime in and help me out, is to look at something like a rice paddy. But there is no water, and so you just have these kind of different places where it looks like there should be something, but there's nothing, and so maybe it's a valley. Or whatever it might be, I don't know. Right. Yeah, well, it almost seems like it would, because what you would do to dig a well is you would dig down very, very deep until you found water. Right, hoping to find some kind of undercurrent or something like that. That's not a guaranteed thing. But here it seems like a miracle that God would be allowed to, that God would allow them to find water here. So I don't know if they're in the middle of the desert. We're being told that they're passing through the wilderness of Edom, which is not that far away from Israel, lots of sand, all that stuff. So maybe there was a water that came through there at some point. But the water would be the same thing. We're getting this picture of dry land. There's no reason for there to be any water here. That's what it is. But what this is really a proof for these people, because God says, you will not see wind or rain, but the wadi or the valley will be filled with water, and you will drink, you and your cattle and your animals. Verse 18, this is easy in the Lord's sight. He will also hand Moab over to you. A little bummer. I'll make sure you have water. But know that this is just a small preview of what I'm giving you. I promise to hand Moab over to you. And then we're back to a Joshua-like command in verse 19. Then you will attack every fortified cut down every tree, stop up every spring, ruin every good piece of land with stones, and the time for the grain offering is the next morning. Water suddenly came from the direction of Edom and filled the land. And there you go. So, what we're told about here in verse 21 and on, because the story right there is just end. We're not told anything about obedience, and so we need to fast forward here to chapter 4 in just a second. But before we do that, in verse 21 to 23 here, we have the Moabites seeing that the waters where they are have turned red. The end of verse 21 tells us they're standing at the border. Verse 22, they got up early in the morning, and the sun was shining on the water, and the Moabites saw that the water across from them was red like blood. I don't know if it's a trick of the eyes or if God caused them to really be this convinced, but man, for you to make such a declaration in verse 23, this is blood. they exclaim, the kings have crossed swords and their men have killed one another. Who despoiled Moab? God does this sort of thing quite a bit, where there's just absolute confusion and false assurances for the enemy that leads them and gives them the hand of Israel. In this case, Israel, Judah, Edom. Okay. Verse 24. However, when the Moabites came to Israel's camp, the Israelites attacked them, and they fled from them. So Israel went into the land attacking the Moabites. And here we go, a repeat of verse 19 in action, in obedience. Let's see, verse 25. Well, yeah, they would destroy the cities, and each of them would throw a stone to cover every good piece of land. They would stop up every spring, cut down every good tree, and this went on only until the buildings of Kir Hareseth were left, and then men with slings surrounded the city and attacked it. Verse 26, when the king of Moab saw that the battle was too fierce for him, he took 700 swordsmen with him to try to break through to the king of Edom, but they could not do it. So he took his firstborn son, who was to become king in his place, and offered him as a burnt offering on the city wall. Great wrath was on the Israelites, and they withdrew from him and returned to their land. All right. There's a lot of things there at the end, but essentially the Moabites were fought back again, taken back to their land, all that stuff, and of course they lost this battle. It was such a tragic way for it to end, as the king of Edom offers his own son as a sacrifice. No, absolutely not. Certainly a target is on your head, and that's what this king is trying to do, is to say, look, my line's at an end, I'm not going to be a threat to you anymore, please don't continue this fight. And it's as if, as we're told here at the end of verse 27, great wrath was on the Israelites. It's as if God is withdrawing himself from this battle, saying, we're done. Right, we did what we needed to do. I made it so that you got this far. You're done. And I feel like since the chapter 3 as it started out was really just about Moab not giving a tributary to the northern kingdom. When it says was on Israel or on the Israelites, I think it is specifically talking about the northern kingdom. It says that they're taking it too far, and they're the ones who brought about the death of this firstborn son unnecessarily. My opinion, but I'm sure it can be read multiple ways. Alright, so that is a war. It's a battle scene, it's typical king fashion. And then in chapter 4, what we have is a return to form about what Elisha is doing, was doing, and continues He's not meant to be a prophet of war. He is defending God's people, helping them understand his will. Chapter 4 is a little bit more of a return to form. And I want to see if we can make these connections and parallels to what's going on in chapter 4 with chapter 3. Sell the oil, pay your debt, you and your sons, and live on the rest. Very, very interesting here. You have a newly widowed woman, and her husband was who again? Another way of saying, not that he's a kid, but to say that he is another in the line of, he is a kind of prophet. Maybe he's one of the lesser prophets, so he doesn't get a minor prophet book. But he's somebody who's not to speak for God, and on God's behalf. But he is somebody who Elisha has a connection with. And this little miracle here is just a very small reminder. That was turned into wine for sure, or I think particularly, as we're going to see here in just a second, another version of breaking bread and feeding the 4,000 or the 5,000, and you just keep on, break it, pass it down, break it, pass it down. It's like, oh wait, so his Happy Meal from McDonald's just says 10,000 plus. That's what's going on here, and I love that Elisha even includes this in verse 3, do not just get a few containers, right? don't think this is going to be something small, like everyone's going to chip in a little bit here. I've heard some sermons where they'll do that with the feeding of the 4,000 or the 5,000, where they said that it's a spirit of generosity that made it so everyone was fed. No, this is not about neighborly goodness for everyone reaching deep in their pockets. This is the infinite God of the universe saying, is there anything I can't do? Is there any provision that you lack that I filled up to the brim. And I imagine, like, think about my coffee with this. So if I just have this much left and I have another cup the exact same size here, I could keep pouring and I put it back down. It'd be the same size and this would be full. Oh, new cup. I'll get another cup. Okay. If only that were the real one. But that's what's happening for her. Is she put it back down. She's like, ah, that's not enough. Well, give me another empty jar. Keep pouring, pouring, pouring. Well, that's the exact thing. Oh, that's cool. I think that that kind of one by one, just seeing it, it does something to you when you see your obedience have this miraculous result. I don't know if you've had that experience before, but it's one that makes much of. That is what faith is about when you think about what it means to be in God's Word and to study it through the eyes of faith. It is enough for the next step. That's what obedience is taking that step, one step at a time. That's why Psalm 119, verse 125, God's Word is a lamp to our feet and a light to our path. Woman, and this would have been another thing almost exact to what happened in Elijah's ministry. So we're about to hear about a Shunammite woman and the way that she cared for Elisha. I'm trying to remember where the woman is from. In 1 Kings, I want to say 19, where she is from. My factory messed up here. I don't know. It did succeed. It succeeded at Mount Carmel. So it's chapter 17 here. Zarephath. That's where it was. Okay. So this widow back in chapter 17. I'm not expecting you to know geography of ancient Near Eastern places, and I don't. Yeah, it's okay. But what might be known here is this widow from Zarephath and this Shunammite woman, you might make the guess of this, neither one of them are Jewish. Neither one of them are Israelites or descendants of Israel. They're foreigners. And yet, it's so amazing how God does this other part of justice where he does not only care about the widows of Jerusalem, but of the world. And so back in 1 Kings 17, and now we're going to see this in 2 Kings 4, you have a foreign woman who is being cared for by God's foremost prophet. The foremost care of God at this moment in history is a woman who is down on her luck. but we're told some things that are different about this. So the inclusion of the widow in the first seven verses, it's as if that's meant to make you think of the widow in verse 7, or chapter 17 in 1 Kings, and then what happens next is meant to help you connect the dots with the other part of the story. So verse 8 and 9 and 10 here, we're introduced to what she does. One day Elisha went to Shunem. A prominent woman who lived there persuaded him to eat some food, so whenever he passed by, he stopped there to eat. Then she said to her husband, I know that the one who often passes by here is a holy man of God, so let's make a small, walled-in upper room and put a bed, a table, a chair, and a lamp there for him. Whenever he comes, he can stay there. a reverence here for him being a holy man of God. Contrast that, if you will, to go up, Baldy, go up, right? You can stay here. We literally built a room for you. This upper room would have been similar to thinking about Jesus and him having the Last Supper in the upper room. It's added on for hospitality. That's why you would put an upper room somewhere. If your house is a little adobo thing, hardened clay, it'd probably be a little bit easier to add a second floor, right? You wouldn't want to live there. So it's a bonus room, and it's meant for company. It's meant for hospitality. All right. Verse 11 and 12 here. One day he came there and stopped at the upstairs room just to lie down. He ordered his attendant, Gehazi, call this Shunammite woman. So he called her, and she stood before him. Then he said to Gehazi, say to her, look, you've gone to all this trouble for us. What can we do for you? Can we speak on your behalf to the king or to the commander of the army? She answered, I am living among my own people. So she doesn't have any trouble. She's accepted in society. She's doing well. I like to say this about Mooresville just in general because I think it's helpful to understand our community, our context. Mooresville is a very content community. I'm good. You're good. We have what we need. I'm fine. You're fine. That's where this woman is at. She is a suburbanite, and she's good. I don't even think. So I think that's helpful to say what comes next. Well, verse 14. So he asked her, then what should be done for her? Gehazi answered, well, she has no son, and her husband's old. Quick, throw out some names. Can we think of anybody who's been old or a woman who's been barren that God maybe intervened? Yeah, think about Sarah. Of course, Abraham being 100. Yeah. Any others? No. Yeah. Very advanced in age. Me particularly, I think of Samuel's mom. Just being desperate to have a son. Same thing with Leah, and same thing with Rachel. Thinking back on history. All right. But verse 15. Call her, Elisha said. So Gehazi called her and stood in the doorway. Elisha said, at this time next year, you will have a son in your arms. And then she said, no, my Lord, man of God, do not lie to your servant. Verse 17, the woman conceived and gave birth to a son at the same time the following year. Elisha was gone. Maybe that's a miracle. But this story has a very quick turn. The child grew and one day went out to his father and the harvesters. Suddenly he complained to his father, my head, my head. His father told the servant, carry him to his mother. So he picked him up, took him to his mother. The child sat in her lap until noon and then died. She went up, laid him on the bed of the man of God, shut him in, and left. So remember that upper room, and we're saying this is a spare room, and so just, we don't know what to do with him. Just put him somewhere where we can't see him, for one. They're almost treating it like a temporary tomb, even, some kind of morgue. But verse 22, she summoned her husband and said, please send me one of the servants and one of the donkeys so I can hurry to the man of God and come back again. But he said, why go to him today? It's not a new moon or a Sabbath. She replied, everything is all right. Does anyone else have a different translation there in verse 23, what she says? It would be all right. Okay. Yeah. Verse 24. She's going to repeat that little phrase. She saddled the donkey and said to her servant, go fast. Don't slow the pace for me unless I tell you. So she came to the man of God at Mount Carmel. So this is like some kind of, place of renewal, like you have a cabin out in Gatlinburg or something. That's what Mount Carmel is to Elisha. I think that's a great, renewed here. When the man of God saw her at a distance, he said to his attendant, Gehazi, the same guy from earlier, "Look, there's the Shunammite woman. Run out to meet her and ask, 'Are you all right? Is your husband all right? Is your son all right?'" And she answered, there you go. "No, it doesn't." And I think that might be why the plus, your translation says it will be all right. Is that what, did it do it again? It is. That's so interesting. I don't have the original text in front of me, but that would be a very striking thing to know if she said it even a little bit different, or if the translator is just, it's very repetitive. It's one of the easiest ways to find out what the original language is. Check with the other translations. And yeah, it's pretty undeniable here. Everything's good. We're good. I'm good. My son's good. I'm like, "Your son is dead. What do you mean?" So there is a remarkable amount of faith in this woman who just knows he's a holy man, he's a man of God, and she knows what he can do. Not because of any miracle that he's done for her. She's been nothing but hospitable. That's it. No expectation of anything in return. And I don't think that she expects something here. She just knows everything's good. Everything's fine. Goes well. We'll press on. Verse 27. When she came up to the man of God at the mountain, she clung to his feet. Gehazi came to push her away, but the man of God said, "Leave her alone. She is in severe anguish." Just note that contrast there. What's your translation for how she's doing? She is in. Her soul, yeah, okay. Talk about your soul, you're usually thinking about your throat, even that kind of clench tightening of it. It's interesting how that literal meaning of it is helpful in just how we even talk. To say she is not all right. She is in her faith, but the situation is not okay. That's just a remarkable thing that you can experience as a Christian. The world can literally be crumbling around you, and you can say, "It is well. It's all right. It's all right." That's peace you can't buy, you know. But it is meant to be ours to say, some trial or blessing or whatever, it's all joy. That's how I will see it. And you can still have these moments where you're saying, "But God changed these circumstances." She is in severe anguish, and the Lord has hidden it from me. He hasn't told me. So verse 28, then she said, "Did I ask my Lord for a son? Didn't I say, 'Do not lie to me'?" So Elisha said to Gehazi, "Tuck your mantle under your belt, take my staff with you, and go." This whole tucking your mantle thing. What does anyone else have, like, "gird your loins" in their translation? Oh, yours does, Marvin? Yeah, that's called everybody had a long gown-like garment on. So if you were going to move fast, you got to wrap that thing up and tie it around your waist. And yeah, it looks a little bit similar to how a diaper might look, or a sumo wrestler. You know what I mean? That's how they would literally gird their loins. But that's what's going on. Go quickly. Take my staff with you and go. If you meet anyone, don't stop to greet them. If a man greets you, don't answer him. Then place my staff on the boy's face. The boy's mother said to Elisha, "As the Lord lives, and if you yourself live, I will not leave you." Anybody remember a similar phrase? The "I will not leave you" part of this? Think about this. Last week, chapter 2, Elijah, the time has come for Elijah to be taken up in the whirlwind. And Elisha is the one who keeps saying to Elijah, "As the Lord lives, I will not leave you." It's almost this deep concern that Elisha's going to go away before the problem is solved. Gehazi went ahead of them, placed the staff in the boy's face, but there was no sound or sign of life. And so he went back to meet Elisha and told him the boy didn't wake up. Verse 32, when Elisha got to the house, he discovered the boy lying dead on his bed. So he went in, closed the door behind the two of them, and prayed to the Lord. Then he went up and lay on the boy, and he put mouth to mouth, eye to eye, hand to hand. And while he bent down over him, the boy's flesh became warm. Elisha got up, went into the house, and paced back and forth, and then he went up, bent down over him again. The boy sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes. This is the weirdest. Just as a picture, as somebody from kids ministry, my background, I get all kinds of weird feelings about what's going on here. But I think what we need to see here is not to get caught up in the particulars of how God raised someone from the dead, but rather to go back and look again at 1 Kings 17. If you want to do that, you can. Or you can just remind us. What did Elijah do to raise the widow's son in 1 Kings 17? Another detail that doesn't happen here, and that's Elijah spread himself out on the boy 3 times, which is essentially what this means. This whole eye to eye, hand to hand, mouth to mouth. I don't think this is meant to be CPR. I don't know what this is, to be honest. I truly don't. But there is a resurrection that occurs, and it's Elisha doing exactly what Elijah did. So I know he did this, so I'll just do that. I don't have a better explanation for that. I appreciate thoughts if you have them. But it's very interesting here that this is what it takes for the boy's flesh to become warm. And it says he's now just sick. He went from dead to sick. Okay, yes, that's better. And then he sneezed 7 times and opened his eyes, comes to consciousness. He's better. Verse 36, Elisha called Gehazi and said, call the Shunammite woman. He called her and she came. Then Elisha said, pick up your son. She came, fell at his feet, bowed to the ground. She picked up his son and left. Well, I don't think it means, like, left the house. I think it just means, like, left the room. And, like, and that was that. End of story. Come on to the next one. These really do come, like, rapid fire, one by one, next to next. The last two are very brief, and so I'll just summarize here. One of them is a pot of poison stew that Elisha, for whatever reason, to heal. Verse 41, the summary. Elisha said, get some flour, threw it in the pot, served the people to eat, and there's nothing bad in the pot. Verse 42 to 44, the last miracle before the big story of Naaman, which we'll talk about next week, is as a farmer coming back with 20 loaves of bread, the first of the harvest, and then he has to feed 100 men. And you're like, how is that going to work? And you better believe there will be leftovers. Verse 44, so he set it before them as the Lord had promised. They ate and had some leftovers. So another instance very much like the feeding of the 4,000, 5,000. Breaks the bread, goes on to more, pour the oil, it keeps on pouring. Something is poisonous. A child dies unceremoniously after miraculously being born, and he is brought back to life, given back to the woman. It really is interesting. If you look at these stories just as miracles, it's almost easy to just let it kind of fly over your head. Like, that's a nice story. I think the thing that gives these stories meaning, or maybe a deeper meaning for us, is to kind of see how each one of these is a story of faith. I'd like to do as we're looking to conclude here, we could say it's very obvious to see the first woman kept collecting containers, and then she poured the oil. She trusted that God would bless her immensely, even miraculously. This hospitable woman, her son died and was brought back to life, but what's her part in the story? Where is her faith? Oh, I'm sorry, the Shunammite woman, the one that we just focused on here, as the son was raised from the dead, what's her faith in this story? How do we see her in action? But obviously, God does the resurrection. God always does the resurrection. But there is an element of faith involved in all of these. I think we don't want to think. Where do we see that with the Shunammite woman? That's right. Did you have something left? Yeah, with her son. Yeah, absolutely. I think that really is the intentionality here, is to say, are you acting in a way that shows your faith? As she comes to the man of God, everything is all right. that's, I think, the most straightforward part of this for her. No matter what happens, everything's all right. It is well with my soul. There is a day when that son will be given back. There is a day when I will not run out of food. There is a day when I will not get sick from some poison. Those things will disappear and go away. And that's a great motivation of our faith. So even in these last two things, there's somebody who has to eat the stew after Elisha says, it's good. It's been cleaned. I just think about that person. Well, I declared it as clean by throwing flour in it. Yeah, Elisha, give it a shot. Yeah, you tell us, does it need more salt? Or this man who is literally giving up his life's income here, the first fruit of the harvest, or what is it, grain? First grain of the harvest, I guess. His livelihood is being given away, offered up, and trust that God would be able to return it in some way, whatever that might be. So I just lose my first loaves of barley bread for the harvest, and, well, I just got to hold on and buckle down. I'll do that, if that's what needs to happen. But here's 100 men, and they need to eat, so I'm going to do it. That's probably where we need to stop for the day, but we're going to continue to see these things, and it's very interesting how the story of Elisha is going to continue to impact Russia, the Northern Kingdom, or the Southern Kingdom, but these outposts, these other nations, these other people, because the whole point of God blessing Elisha, enabling him to be his word, is that all the nations would be blessed through God's people. So it's as if there's a call to faith on our lives, not just for our own benefit, but so that others would come to save themselves. And that I think really is a surprising message for the book of Kings. It can be so caught up in political antics or strange miracles or kids yelling baldy baldy and then getting eaten by bears. This is a story of God's continued faithfulness to use broken people to lead them to faith. Anything else for today? Thanks so much for sharing or discuss. Dear God, thank you so much for your word, for stories that call us to faith, to grow our faith, and to trust you ahead of time before you prove that you're going to do something, that you are going to do it, that you are a trustworthy God who we can put our faith in and look to you to keep your promise and to do it again and again, to give up what we have in our hand, to gain the things that we cannot see. That is what we're hoping for. That is all of our hope and all of our peace, is to gain something that we cannot see, someone that we cannot hold right now, and that's Jesus Christ. He has proven this to us, proven our faith, and finished it, dying on the cross, rising from the dead, ascending to the heavens, and coming again. We trust you and praise you.